Our guest speaker today is Dr. Terry Jones, who is the internship coordinator and professor emeritus at the University of Missouri at St. Louis. Dr. Jones earned his PhD at Georgetown University. He is the author of three books: The Metropolitan Chase, Politics and Policies in Urban America; Fragmented by Design, Why St. Louis Has So Many Governments; and Conducting Political Research, as well as dozens of scholarly articles, book chapters, and technical reports. He has been a consultant to more than 70 governmental and nonprofit organizations and has held office in many professional and community organizations. His current research focuses on metropolitan governance, urban public policy, state government, and public opinion. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Terry Jones.
Thank you very much, Jill, and thank you for inviting me to be with you this morning. I've had the pleasure of speaking with the Ethical Society on the other side of the Missouri River in St. Louis County, and so I'm glad to add the Mid-Rivers chapter to my list. I want to talk about race, public policy, in the St. Louis area. William Faulkner once wrote, "The past is not dead, it's not even past." And that's a reminder that any things that happen decades and even centuries ago can still and do have an enormous impact on the present. And that's certainly the case with race in the St. Louis area. We're going to start, I have a handout here that everybody I think has a copy, or at least if not, one next to you, with the current situation, just a snapshot. So that's the second page after the outline. Racial disparities in the St. Louis region. If you take almost any measure of quality of life, infant mortality rate, income, home ownership, educational attainment, and you look at the average for African Americans in the St. Louis region and the average for whites in the St. Louis region, you see the better number ratio to the not so good number whites to African Americans is typically 2-1, 3-1, sometimes even higher. We are 2017, 2018, still living in a very separate societies in terms of these numbers. And so my presentation is, why is that the case? And of course, the answer to the question, why, has many roads and dimensions, but by far the biggest is we made it that way. That is to say, we constructed public policies and community practices in our region that separated us rather than brought us together. And if we're going to do something to change that, and many people, including I know all of you in this room, are trying to accomplish that, we can do it better if we have an understanding of how this problem got to be, because we're digging ourselves out of a hole, and the more we know about the hole in which we're digging out of, the more accomplished and more motivated we'll be as a result. So we're going to pick up the story. The story is going to start when this area became part of the United States of America early in the 19th century through the Louisiana Purchase. As we dove through the story, and it's not going to be one date after another, so don't get nervous here. I do want to draw your attention to this timeline. And I'll be referring to it a bit as I make my remarks. First of all, it starts in the early 19th century. We're now in the early 21st century, over 200 years later. Okay. As we look back, it's very easy to think of the years that we've lived as equal in their experience. The years that come before we came, we tend to truncate. But they obviously lasted just as long as the years we're living through ourselves. I mention that because if you look, calculate the number of years where we had slavery or mandated legal segregation, that's about 150 out of those 220. It's only in the last 70 or so that we've had something other than that. Of course, that's when we've been, though, and so we tend to think about that as the totality or much of the totality. We have this burden of what happened before those 70 or earlier years in which we've lived. I'm going to talk about these era, this era in three components. One is a common root in slavery, which was the first 60 or so years of our existence as a United States occupied and controlled, governed area. And then after the Civil War, which ended slavery, talk about two strands, each of which is very important for having an equal chance in society. One is public education, and to a lesser extent, private education as well, because we believe in our Declaration of Independence that all men should have an equal right, all persons should have an equal opportunity for the good life. And how do we translate that equal opportunity in terms of our public policies? In many ways, but by far the most important of those is public education, a free public education, K through 12, and a subsidized education, if you so choose, at the higher educationist level. The other strand is residential choice. A cliche in the real estate industry, of course, is location, location, location. And what that reminds us of is that it's not simply the dwelling itself in which we reside and its features. It's where that dwelling is located has a whole lot to do with the value of that dwelling in terms of access to public services, safety, education, and so forth. So let's return to 1803. Welcome to the United States. We've just been bought by that government. We no longer are a French territory. So we are now a territory of the United States of America. We're going to call ourselves, they told us this, we're the territory of Louisiana, the District of Louisiana. Well, territories need laws that by which they govern and themselves. So one of the choices this new territory had is where it's going to, it's, how is it going to deal with slavery as part of its new ordinances. At that time, the prevailing practice at the national level was to acknowledge, not publicly so much as privately, that we were living a huge contradiction. If you looked at our Constitution and our Declaration of Independence, by and large, they talked about everybody being equal. But we not only practiced slavery, laws allowed slavery in many of the states. The way in which the founding fathers, not all of them, but most of them dealt with this was to say, well, if we can keep the problem from spreading any, it'll go away. Might take a century or so, but it'll die of its own weight at some point. So our policy was, at the national level, no more slavery anywhere else other than the original southern states that were part of the United States. But this area said, no, 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 we want slavery here also because we're already practicing it. We want to keep it. So if you look at those ordinances, the next page on your handout has an excerpt from the laws of the District of Louisiana. You'll see, which were approved in 1804, these are some elements of that. No slave shall go from the tenements of his master without a pass or some letter or token whereby it may appear that he is proceeding by authority from his master. If he does not, it shall be lawful for any person, any white person, to apprehend and carry him before a justice of the peace to be by his order punished with stripes. That authorized any white to stop any African American any time for any reason and we're going to take you in and see whether or not you have a right to be here. And that final phrase, all Negro and mulatto slaves and all courts of judicature within this district shall be held, taken, and adjudged to be personal estate. This foreshadowed the Dred Scott decision later in the 19th century. The key part of it was people are people, slaves are not people, they are property, personal estate. Well, 20 years later, not quite 20 years later, a portion of the District of Louisiana, the portion that we now call Missouri, wanted to be a state within the United States. That would elevate our status and give us more authority, more sovereignty, indeed sovereignty over our own affairs. Again, the prevailing practice was don't let slavery spread to new states as they are being formed and included in the United States. Missouri said, nope, we have to have slavery, continue to have slavery, and that's going to be part of our negotiations, and we're not going to back down on that particular point. And we won. As to say, the United States said, okay, you can come in. We'll have another state, we'll call it Maine, come in as a free state, so we'll maintain some balance in the U.S. Senate, but we'll add Missouri to the list of slave states in the United States. We go another 25 or so years into the slavery period, the first part of the 19th century. Abolitionist movement is growing in Missouri and across the country. Slave forces still were the controlling political entity within the state, so they lobbied the state government, would need to work too hard, to toughen Missouri's posture towards African Americans. In 1847, they passed a law, and that's also on the same page as the laws of the District of Louisiana. I won't go through all of it. I'll just start with and end with the first one. It made it a felony for any individual to educate an African American. And that law was enforced. And it was a felony, not a misdemeanor. You went to jail for it. Okay. So we not only practice slavery in Missouri, we practice it in a way through the state laws where the government was very much involved and on the pro-slave side, and we deprived African Americans of any opportunity for an education. Then we have the Civil War. And Missouri was a very unusual situation. There were a couple of other examples, Maryland, for example, as one of them. Missouri continued to practice slavery through the Civil War until the 13th Amendment was passed, but stayed on the side of the Union. That meant that when the Union won, the North won, Missouri was not an occupied territory, as were the southern states that were the part of the Confederacy. So we did not have Reconstruction, which provided 15 or so years of positive experiences for African Americans, opportunities. We went straight to Jim Crow. So if you're asking, where did Jim Crow start? Where did the legally mandated segregation start? Where were its origins? And the answer is, they were its origins in Missouri. Let me now take that thought and go through two strains that I've already mentioned, education and residential choice. Hi there. If you go back to this timeline, public education, that is to say education supported by state tax dollars and local tax dollars and free to the individuals and their parents who were being educated, started to come into existence in the 1830s and 1840s. There's no mention of education in the U.S. Constitution. It's been a state policy in the United States, a state-by-state development. But by the time of the Civil War, there were public schools for all whites. Those school districts were given a choice at the end of the Civil War by the state of Missouri that they could either set up separate schools for African Americans or they could integrate those students in the existing schools. All public school districts in Missouri chose to have separate schools for African Americans. Missouri rewrote its constitution in 1875. Big deal. That's when the city of St. Louis was able to get provisions in the constitution to separate itself from the rest of St. Louis County, for example. When it rewrote the constitution in 1875, it no longer was an option for a school district as to whether or not it wanted integrated or segregated public schools. It was a mandate. You had to have segregated public schools. So from 1875 forward to the 1954 Bowen v. Board of Education decision, Missouri had mandated segregation in its public schools. In 1875, the St. Louis Public School District, which had over 80% of the African-American students living within its boundaries, set up a high school for African-Americans, Sumner High School. And it was the building that in which it was housed was a dilapidated building on the edge of downtown St. Louis, about where Clark and Tucker are right now, if you want the location. That was 1875. If you look at that timeline under educational opportunity, the first African-American high school in 1875, and then see when the next high school was for African Americans was established, you're going to go over 50 years, 52 years to be precise. Then a second high school, Vachon, was set up in the city of St. Louis, and a year later, the first African American high school in St. Louis County, Douglas High in North Webster Groves. By the time we get to the late 1920s, there are roughly 60,000 African Americans living in the city of St. Louis, St. Louis County, St. Charles County combined. So that meant if you, right before Vachon opened and Douglas opened, if you were an African American household wanting to send your child to a public school living in any one of those three jurisdictions, you had to get that child to the Sumner High School, which is now located, which was in the early 20th century built a new building in the Bill neighborhood, the building that still occupies to this day. You needed to get your child to that building for that high school education. As we're all aware, parochial education is about the practice for about one out of every five students in the St. Louis metropolitan area. They attend the parochial schools rather than the public schools. And the largest by far of that was Catholic schools. Catholic schools were also segregated. And so there was only one Catholic high school, also located, St. Joseph's, also located in North St. Louis, and not established until the early 20th century. The story of higher education is very similar, okay, in terms of access to and opportunity for. The first African American university was established in this Missouri in 1887 in Jefferson City, and even that was because the federal government essentially mandated that every state that was receiving so-called Morrill Act funds, this funds extension, ironically, the building we're now in. If you're receiving those funds, and the University of Missouri was a recipient of those funds, the land-grant university in the state of Missouri, you either need to start admitting African Americans to your land-grant university or set up another one for them. Missouri chose to set up another one for African Americans. That was Lincoln. But it underfunded that institution then and now, and it underprogrammed it. There were no professional programs, law, dentistry, medicine, for example. There was also one small entity within the city of St. Louis, Stowe Teachers College, which owned and operated by the St. Louis Public Schools, which offered one degree, elementary education, for one purpose, to train individuals to teach in the African-American segregated schools in the city of St. Louis. St. Louis University and Washington University were the primary institutions for higher education during this entire period, between the second half of the 19th century through the middle of the 20th century. Both of them were segregated, which is to say they were really not segregated. They did not admit African Americans. So that opportunity, that window, and both of those institutions then, not the case now, were primarily commuter institutions. So that was the way in which whites were able to achieve a college education, but not African Americans. After Brown v. Board of Education, and actually in a lesser starting in the 1940s, this began to loosen a bit. And of course, Brown said no more. But what was the reaction in the 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s? By and large, St. Louis's reaction to providing expanded educational opportunities, including integrated education, to African Americans was passive resistance. Let's take K through 12 for starters. When Brown was handed down in 1954, almost 85% of the African American students in the city, in the St. Louis area on the Missouri side, were in the city of St. Louis. City of St. Louis then and now was highly segregated residentially. The practice of the city public schools was neighborhood-based schools, which meant you went from segregation by law, by mandate under the 1875 Constitution, then post-1954 to segregation by fact, because of the residential neighborhood situation. Under some pressure from the federal government in the 1960s, as well as some local, but not as much pressure at the local level, the city started to bus some students, African-American students, from the north part of the city to the south part, seemingly integrating to some extent by building, But the way they did it, by and large, was to take African-Americans from the north, take them to a building, a school building in South St. Louis that had space and had white students, and set up a separate classroom for the African-Americans. So the building was integrated, but the classrooms were not integrated. So that was the way things stood until we got to the 1970s. Now some of us in this room are alive, right? Not only alive, we're adults, just localized. A group of African-American parents in the city of St. Louis said that this is not good. They sued. That suit took about 10 years to get its way through the courts, a variety of starts and stops, resulted in a voluntary agreement between the city of St. Louis, the state of Missouri, school districts in the St. Louis County for having a transfer program, which was not really voluntary, although it's called that, because it was a part of a federal court settlement. And that program was in existence from the early 1980s until 1999. At its peak, it allowed about 15,000 African-American students to go to high school and elementary schools, to school districts in St. Louis County, thereby broadening significantly the options they had for education. Did some other things as well. I'd be happy to answer questions about why it stopped, but it did stop. It was another negotiated settlement, and there was going to be a phase-out of the program, and it is in a phase-out process. Ultimately, it was going to be about a 10-year phase-out, going from 99 to about 2011. It's been extended, but now a firm date has been set for the phase-out, and it'll be fully phased out by early in the 2030s. Taking a step back, passive resistance after Brown, then a program that didn't provide significant opportunity but for less than two decades, and then a phase out of that program. At the higher education level, there was also passive resistance. The St. Louis U and Washington U started to admit African Americans, but primarily to graduate programs, not as part of their undergraduate courses. The University of Missouri St. Louis, from which I came in 1969, when I came from Kansas State University, we had our African-American enrollment was roughly 5% of our student body at a time when of the college-age cohort, African-Americans were about 20% of the population. By 20 years later, that 5% had become 5%. And that 20 was now closer to 25%. We only got serious about that at UMSL in the 1980s. We've made significant progress since then. We're now close to 20% African-American enrollment. The University of Missouri-Columbia was slower, and you all have read about that over the last few years. Washington U and St. Louis U did not get serious about reaching out and having a proactive form of integration of their undergraduate student bodies until the 1990s. So there's the education story. Residential choice. We're going to start that story in the early part of the 20th century, when we had industrialization and a great migration, that's the term typically used for it, of people moving from the rural South to the industrial Midwest, to places like Chicago, Detroit, St. Louis. And that was both whites and African Americans. Between the late 19th century and the early 19-teens, the African-American population in the city of St. Louis grew to about 60,000 individuals within a overall population of 700,000. And the real estate industry said this creates, from our perspective, a real problem in terms of housing values. How are we going to handle it? Well, they took advantage of a new thing called an initiative petition, which the new 1914 city's charter had put in as part of it, where you could, if you got enough signatures, put a proposal on the ballot. And they did that to do a zoning ordinance that would segregate city housing, that blocks would either be all white or all African American. You can see a copy of the ordinance. City of St. Louis Initiative Petition. because they said that would promote the general welfare of white and colored people, respectively. And if you look at the map, this would have been the zoning map under that ordinance, which would essentially have restricted African Americans to two areas. One, the dark area you see in the middle of the map is the known then and still to some extent now as the Mill Creek Valley. That's the area from roughly Jefferson Avenue on the east to Grand Avenue on the west, from Delmar on the north to the railroad tracks or Interstate 64 now on the south. And that was already a neighborhood of roughly 20,000 African Americans. It was the lowest income area and within the city of St. Louis, although it was a thriving neighborhood. The other was an area in North St. Louis called the Ville neighborhood, V-I-L-L-E neighborhood, where Sumner High School was located, which was more of a lower middle class as opposed to a lower class area. And that was at that point primarily white, but there were some African Americans in it, so it was going to be an encouragement to make that an African American island and a white sea. But a similar ordinance had been passed in Cincinnati and Louisville. Federal courts below the Supreme Court said those ordinances were unconstitutional. So the St. Louis ordinance did not go into effect. As a result of that, the real estate industry said, well, what else can we do since we can't do it this way? So they took advantage of another thing that had been tried in some other metropolitan areas called a restrictive covenant. And if you look at below the initiative petition warning, you can see the wording of a typical restrictive covenant. What they did was to concentrating on the area around the Ville neighborhood, which were all white, they went to those white households and asked them if they would add a covenant to their deed of trust that would voluntarily restrict their ability to do anything except sell or rent their property to another white person. You might say, well, that's a private act of discrimination. Yes, it is, until somebody violates the covenant. Then what are you going to do other than say, you violated the covenant? You're going to go to court. What are the courts going to do? Are they going to enforce the covenant? And the Missouri courts enforced this covenant. So what was not able to be accomplished by ordinance was able to be accomplished by the covenants because they were very successful in getting people to add them to their deeds of trust. And so what you saw on that zoning map became reality, not through because it was part of the zoning ordinance, but because of the restrictive covenant movements. So the answer to the question, why is the city of St. Louis so residentially segregated, is it started out that way. Why did it start out that way? Because these devices were put into place to make it happen. It was not simply an act of individual preferences. Well, we get a lot of Supreme Court cases here. We had a case coming out of St. Louis in the late 1940s about the restrictive covenants. Supreme Court said in that case, Shelley v. Kramer, they're unconstitutional, can't do that any longer. Well, then what happened? Would we become more residentially integrated? Well, we had another movement at that time. We call it suburbanization. So if you look at this table, St. Charles County stories later, okay, so I'm not going to talk about that now, but I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have about it. The suburbanization of the 1950s and 60s occurred primarily in St. Louis County. Between 1950 and 1970, St. Louis County went from about 400,000 people to about 1 million people. So if you want to think of it, two St. Charles counties, one every decade, one in the 50s, one in the 60s. And it was a pretty even flow in terms of 30,000 or so per year. Let me draw your attention to the 1950 line and the 1960 line. So in 1950, you can see there were about 390,000 whites and about 17,000 African Americans. By 1960, the number of whites had grown by 300,000, almost 700,000. The number of African Americans had grown by 2,000. Was only whites suburbanizing? And the answer is yes, And the answer to the question, why is that, is that the developers of subdivisions in St. Louis County and apartment complex in St. Louis County said almost to a developer, we don't sell, we don't rent to African Americans. Until 1968, it was legal to do that in the United States of America, to refuse to sell a piece of property based upon race. So that meant African Americans did not get out on the, get in or were not able to suburbanize until after 1968. They lost out on that 20-year period. That deprived them of the opportunity, for example, to suburbanize for the reasons others were doing it, in part for school quality. It also had a very perverse effect on net worth. If you look at a majority of whites during this period, you get the following story, and I'm going to use myself as an example. My parents moved to St. Louis County in 1949. They're part of this movement. To Brentwood. Bought a home for about $12,000. Okay. By the time they passed away, my dad in the 1980s, my mom in 2005, they had moved up one home, and their real estate was worth about $350,000. Very common story. That meant their family net, our family net worth went up $300,000, basically by doing nothing, just being in the right place at the right time. Okay, it meant that we had something to borrow against for my sisters and my education, helping us with that down payment for that our first home, that sort of thing. Okay. They had some reserves. That was the biggest period, the 50s and the 60s, of capital accumulation in the United States. The biggest in our history. And we have not seen one like that since. African Americans missed out in St. Louis on that ability to add to their network. Then we'll close with what's happened after the 1960s. Let me start the discussion with a couple of numbers, or an index, a metric. How can we measure residential integration or segregation? Well, the most common measure is known as the Tauber Index, after Carl and Alma Tauber, an academic couple that developed it at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And it's a fairly straightforward concept. It says, well, and I'm going to simplify, we're only going to talk about an area that has two races, in this case, black and white. What's the proportion for the overall area? So let's talk about this Missouri side of the St. Louis metropolitan area. And the answer, I'm going to again simplify a little bit. It's 80-20. It's actually a little higher than 20, a little lower than 80. Well, a perfectly integrated neighborhood, well, if every neighborhood, think subdivision, within that metropolitan area is also 80-20, how many African Americans would have to move in order to achieve perfect integration? And the answer is none of them would have to move. Okay, the Tauber Index is into zero. If every neighborhood was either all white or all black, what proportion of the African Americans would have to move? And the answer is all of them would be. So the Tauber Index would be 100. Okay, pretty straightforward concept. The proportion of African Americans that would have to move to achieve neighborhoods that were the same as the overall metropolitan average. The Tauber Index in 1950 was roughly 80%. That is to say, 80% of African Americans would have needed to move to achieve perfect integration. Anybody want to hazard a guess as to what the Tauber Index is right now? Right now being as of 2010. Census? Any guess? No, it's not. We're not perfectly safe. That would be perfect segregation. No, it's went to, come on, you are a really pessimist. it actually went down. It's 75, in mid-70s. So it dropped just a little bit. Although that might be misleading because neighborhoods that are in the process of integrating and then resegregating lower the index, but only for a decade or two, then go back. So we've had very little change in residential integration between 1950 and 2010 and up till today. Why is that the case? Well, there are three reasons. two of which are, I think, probably going to be very straightforward to you, and the other which might not be. So let me talk about the first two, and then that are familiar. First, we've already talked about history. If you start off a certain way, in this case segregated, absent any other action, it's going to stay that way. And we started off in the first part of the 20th century in a segregated fashion. We also maintain that with other zoning practices in St. Louis County, which I've not gone into, be happy to talk about, that deal with the fragmentation issue, in the first two decades of the post-World War II period. So that we set that segregation in place, and we've not done much to change that pattern. The second reason deals with the way in which we go about looking for housing. If you're making a decision about moving, or you're coming into the metropolitan area and making a decision about where you want to live, what are your search processes? Well, we've researched that, and they're pretty obvious. You do two things. You go to a real estate agent, and you talk to family and friends. Well, if you talk to family and friends, and you're already in a segregated environment, they're going to say, well, we live, and your family and friends are of the same race as you, that's going to perpetuate a pattern. Okay. If you go to a real estate agent, and there's been test after test after test of this, doesn't apply 100% of the time, not even 50% of the time, but a disproportionate amount of the time, and we'll use St. Louis County as an example, because it's the prime example in the area, the real estate agent is going to think to him or herself, you know, I want to put this couple in a place where they're comfortable. So if it's an African-American couple, everything about the couples are the same other than their race. If it's an African-American couple, let's make it upper middle class, they're going to say, you know, the Hazelwood area, the upper parts of St. Louis County on the north part, lots of nice housing, lots of people just like you, you're going to be very comfortable there. If it's a white couple, they're going to be talking Chesterfield, Baldwin, Manchester, Wild. So that perpetuates it. Then the third one. Now you're going to have to bear with me just a little bit, because I'm going to go through a chain here. And what I'm about to say does not apply throughout the United States. It only applies, from our research that social scientists have done, in Midwestern industrial cities that have the legacy that we have had, that are primarily white and black and do not have a large third ethnicity within their boundaries. So it applies to Detroit, Chicago, Kansas City, St. Louis, Milwaukee, Cincinnati, you got the drift, Cleveland, Pittsburgh, Baltimore. And it's based on asking people, probability samples, about their housing preferences. You say we're going to do a survey on your preferences about what you would like in your ideal neighborhood. We're talking about commutes and closeness to work, schools. Then after we've established a little rapport, we're going to say, well, what about race? So we're going to ask the white people the following question. What would be your ideal neighborhood in terms of racial composition? Would you like a neighborhood that's 100% white, 90% white, 80% white, going all the way down to 10% white? What do you think are the two most, or what's the most common response? There are actually two most, huh? 100. Very few people say 100%. The two most common responses by whites are 90% and 80%. Then if you ask a follow-up question, why that? Why did you give that number? They said, well, I grew up in a 100% white neighborhood. And I had to learn some things as an adult that I would have liked to have the opportunity to learn as a child in terms of diversity. And I don't want my children to not have that experience. I want them to be some diversity in our neighborhood, and those numbers would achieve that. So keep that in mind, okay? Now we're going to go, same question, African Americans. What would be your ideal composition for the neighborhood? 100% African-American, all the way down to 10% African-American. What do you think is the most common response by African-Americans? Yeah, most common response is 40% and 50%. And the third after that is 30%. Well, and then same thing, you ask a follow-up open-ended question, why that? And they say in one form or another, it's a majority white society. whites run the governments. Okay. I want quality public services. I'm going to have a greater opportunity to have public services of quality if there's a majority white in the neighborhood. But I want enough African Americans around that I don't feel like I'm the only one. Back to our whites, okay? One more question for them. At what point would you not seriously consider a neighborhood? Would you seriously consider a neighborhood that was 90% white? Yeah, sure, I already told you that. 80% white? Again, I already told you that. 70% white? Maybe. 60% white? Unlikely. 50% white? No, I don't think so. And so down. Now put that together. We talk about a neighborhood. People move. People die. People are transferred. It's a neighborhood that's 20 to 25% African American. A home comes onto the market because a white moves, dies. No white flight here. They just, for other reasons. That home is in the sweet spot for an African American. That's the ideal neighborhood in terms of racial composition. It's starting to move out of the sweet spot. Indeed, it has moved out of the sweet spot for a white. That then results over a 10 to 20 year period in a resegregation of neighborhoods. Ferguson was 70% white in 1990. It's 30% white today, or in 2015. So that means if we want integrated neighborhoods, and that's a question, that's not necessarily a statement, that's going to happen only if we do something to counter that force. I don't have a big finish other than to repeat what I said at the beginning. If we are going to improve racial justice and race relations in our community, in our metropolitan community, we need to understand how we got where we are today. And I'm doing all of this aspiration so to help inform you about that and to lead you to that. Thank you for your patience. I've used up most of my time, but I'm happy to spend whatever time Jill has allotted for me for questions. It was already unconstitutional, but it was a little embarrassing that some would argue, that we didn't take formal action to remove it from the Constitution. We let the word stay around for another 20 years. Yes, ma'am. NGA.
Okay. Thank you. What has the policy been to try to make, what are the neighborhoods around that? Cool.
Obviously the aspiration is certainly that to stimulate development. There's already been a successful development, Murphy Park in that area, which is the McCormick Barron Saltazar project, which is now about a 30-year-old neighborhood, which is essentially redivided. One of the discussions we need to have as a community, and we find race discussions about race awkward in our area, is do we want integrated areas? So should that be a middle-class African-American neighborhood by and large, or should it be a middle-class integrated neighborhood that's, say, mixed-race neighborhood? It's certainly going to improve the residential neighborhoods. There'll be a ripple effect from the NGA facility. Yes, ma'am, in the back.
It seems that since whites are more privileged because our parents, their house increased in value, we got that payout later on, the question should be not how many blacks need to move into our neighborhoods, how many whites need to move into the other neighborhoods, and like switching that because we have a privilege in the situation.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, okay.
I think we're out of time.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's nice. Thank you.